Hi, everyone. And I'm back with a discussion of a few things that happened after Vietnam and how that changed basic aspects of U.S. foreign policy. So this is the aftermath of Vietnam in big picture terms. We already looked at the aftermath of Vietnam with respect to intervention itself. But before we move on to look at policies that Richard Nixon initiated, including détente, which is a form of engagement, what we need to do is talk a little bit about the context, big political changes. And we're on slide 13 right now, and you'll see slide 13. Don't worry about writing anything down related to slide 13, because slide 13 is just an outline. It tells you where we're going, and there's a PowerPoint slide, and there'll be a little bit of discussion about each one of these items numbered 1, 2, 3. But this is an outline for what happened big picture-wise in U.S. foreign policy. So, slide 13. Well, let's take a look at the first one, number one, congressional power. And now we move to slide 14. Now, big picture. Again, Congress, after Vietnam, has decided we're going to challenge the president in foreign policy. There's a sense that the presidents had been so dominant in foreign policy since World War II, too dominant, and they've essentially pushed Congress out of the way. Now, we don't need to go back for a lot of history here, but even if you go back to FDR and Lend-Lease, in which the United States is starting to sell naval ships to Britain without essentially congressional approval initially, people looked at that and said, hey, this is violating the Constitution. FDR is just taking care of things, doing things without congressional approval. And the answer was, yes, FDR was doing that. And since World War II, there have been instances which the president basically has moved Congress out of the way. Sometimes people accuse the president of being unconstitutional. Other times it's simply the president acts and Congress simply says, well, what can we do to stop it? We're not sure. And Congress just sort of rolls over and lets the president define foreign policy. Well, in particular, when it came to Vietnam, there was a sense that Lyndon Johnson used the Tonkin Gulf Resolution as almost a war declaration. Now, what does that mean? Again, without a whole lot of detail, in the Tonkin Gulf in August of 1964, some U.S. naval vessels were fired on. And actually, there were two nights in question. One night, the United States naval vessels were actually fired on in the Gulf of Tonkin, right outside Vietnam, if you look on a map. The United States was fired upon. The second night, actually, it's unclear if anything ever happened at all, and the Johnson administration seems to have lied about what actually went on. Well, Johnson at that point asked Congress for a resolution that would allow him to respond to North Vietnamese aggression. That was the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and Congress passed it almost unanimously, gave Lyndon Johnson the ability to respond to North Vietnamese aggression, and Johnson basically used that as the way to fight an entire war and eventually send over 500,000 troops to Vietnam. So there was a sense that Johnson had bowled over Congress, had lied to Congress, and of course then Richard Nixon expands the Vietnam War into Cambodia without congressional approval. There were secret bombing in 1969 and then the invasion in 1970, all of it without congressional approval. So Congress is looking at presidential power and saying, we've got to figure out a way to restrain the president. And the point of it is specifically to say, we want to weaken presidential power in foreign policy. We want to go back to essentially the Madisonian concept of the Constitution of checks and balances. And the thinking is that there are no checks on presidential power when it comes to foreign policy, and things are way out of balance. So Congress wants to change this. In fact, there was a book written in 1973 by Arthur Schlesinger Jr. called The Imperial Presidency, which implied that when it comes to foreign policy, presidents almost had the power of kings. Well, here's the kind of stuff that Congress wanted to do. First thing is the War Powers Resolution in 1973, and there's a link to it right there. Now, the War Powers Resolution was aimed at restricting the presidential use of force, and you'll see the use of force there on the PowerPoint slide. This is what it was about. It was actually passed over a Richard Nixon veto. Congress overrode Richard Nixon in 1973 to pass this resolution. Well, here's what it did. Two big numbers that are important. First legislation says 48 hours, first number that matters. What it means is within 48 hours of the United States using force, And actually, the specific term, I believe, was U.S. forces engaging in imminent hostilities. So the United States is going to use force. Within 48 hours, the president must notify Congress. That's the new rule. So the Congress can't be surprised about ongoing military operations. Within 48 hours, there's got to be approval. So that's the first number that mattered. The second number that mattered is 60 days. Now, once that 48 hours, excuse me, once that notification is given, a 60-day clock begins ticking. Now, what that clock does is it says within 60 days of that notification, Congress must approve of the military operation. So Congress has got to pass a resolution. It doesn't mean a war declaration. It means a congressional approval, some method of congressional approval, a vote of some type, and Congress left flexibility for how Congress would do that. But that has to be done within 60 days. And here's the catch, and here's the important part. Within 60 days, or the troops must come home, the military engagement must stop. So think about that, because that means if Congress does nothing, if Congress can't get its act together, if Congress can't come to a consensus, that itself will stop the military engagement. So it's a sort of a weird power in which if Congress does nothing, it restrains the president. Now, there are people who say that's unconstitutional because the president has the power as commander-in-chief of the U.S. Armed Forces to command the United States military, and every president since then has said that the War Powers Resolution is unconstitutional. Now, of course, if the president says something is unconstitutional and members of Congress say it is constitutional, well, what happens? In theory, the United States Supreme Court is going to decide whether something is constitutional or not, and this legislation has never gotten to the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court has consistently looked at this and said, this is a political battle. This is not a legal battle. Right. This is about Republicans and Democrats. It's not really about Congress and the presidency. And basically looking at the members of Congress and the executive branch and saying, you guys got to sort this one out because this is a political issue. Now, one of the reasons that they've done that is because every time you get near the 60 days, right, and what has happened since then is every time the United States government has used force, every time the president has initiated some kind of military operation, he's notified Congress and specifically mentioned, I'm doing this to comply with the War Powers Resolution. And then if you get within 60 days, I mean, if you get near the end of the 60-day deadline, what Congress has done consistently is said, well, we're not sure whether we want to go on record as supporting this, so what we'll do is we'll give the president another 60 days. Or we'll give the president another 90 days. Or we'll give the president another 180 days. Essentially, they've extended the deadline because they couldn't figure out what to do, and they also didn't want to take responsibility for it. So Congress has said in 1973, we want to do this, we want to take this power, and every time they get to the point where they could use the power, they back off. And that's why the Supreme Court says, this is not a constitutional issue. This is garbage and we won't listen to it. So Congress keeps backing away from that aspect of the responsibility. And actually, since then, when you look at some major wars, for instance, you look at the two wars against Iraq in 1990, 1991, and then in 2003, in both cases, presidents named George Bush actually asked Congress for a resolution, not a war declaration, but a resolution in support of the use of force, and Congress has given it. It said, sure, we'll support it. Also, after September 11th, there was the authorization to use military force in September of 2001, about a week later, which authorized the president to essentially fight al-Qaeda. We'll get to that when we talk about George W. Bush. So actually, even if Congress didn't use its power and really enforce this and say, Mr. President, we're going to be a partner with this, it actually caused the president and Congress to start doing what they should do is get together and try to pass legislation, if not a war declaration, that authorizes the president to use force. So in some ways, it created an environment, maybe a culture, to say Congress has got to go on record here, even though Congress has never used its power to turn around and say, Mr. President, we're going to stop you from this military engagement. They haven't done it. Now, let's move to slide 15. Now, here's where Congress actually did use its power. congressional power, the real power, is money. Think about it. Foreign policy, presidents can do whatever they want. They can speak out, they can criticize, they can make all the speeches in the world. But what is United States foreign policy? It's some kind of policy that is actually costing money. Anything the United States government does costs money. And when you spend money, then Congress is involved automatically because money can only be budgeted or spent through legislation. It's a legal process. So therefore, Congress has got to be involved in it. So you'll pass a yearly budget for operating the United States government. But then if there's a foreign policy crisis or something that needs to be done overseas, presidents will ask for more money, and Congress will then have to appropriate more money. So that's where Congress's real power is, in saying, Mr. President, you can talk about something all you like, but you can't spend a dime. And that's where Angola and the Clark Amendment comes up. Well, again, for a lot of these case studies, you could go about 1,000 years with all of these issues. We will not do that. We'll only go back about 400 or so, very briefly. If you see Angola, a little map there in southwestern Africa, can't really see it well, but that yellow part there is Namibia, and then you'll see if you go farther south, you'll see South Africa. So it's a part of a country in southern Africa. It had been colonized by the Portuguese since the 16th century, and there were rebel groups that were fighting the Portuguese by the early 1960s. Three major rebel groups, all allied with different countries in the region. You don't need to know all this, but there was the MPLA, which was backed by the Soviet Union. There was the FNLA, backed by the United States. And there was UNITA, backed by South Africa. So three different groups. Their ideologies were slightly different. They were from different ethnic groups, which was the real key reason why they were fighting each other. Angola is one of those countries in Africa that was created by Europeans. They drew the map. The map had nothing to do with the history of Angola. So you had this country, which was not given independence when most of the countries in Africa were given their independence in the early 1960s. The Portuguese held on to it into the 1970s. Well, the MPLA was backed by the Soviet Union. The FNLA backed by the United States. Obviously, that's a Cold War issue right there. So you can see that this is part of the regional conflict problems. Well, there was a coup in Portugal in the early 1970s, and Portugal decides it's going to leave Angola in the mid-1970s. Well, what happens is this turns into a ramped-up civil war, because now it's not about fighting the Portuguese, it's about who's going to control Angola after the Portuguese leave. So, obviously, the United States and the Soviet Union look at Angola and say, it's not going to be a colony. The United States wants to turn it blue on that big map of the world that shows the blue and red countries. The Soviets, of course, want it to be red. The United States is throwing money into the FNLA war efforts. The Soviets are throwing money into the MPLA. Both of them are backing their allies with weapons, and you've got this large civil war. Now, this is going on 1974, 1975, just as the United States is pulling out of Vietnam. Members of Congress look at Angola and say, this looks just like Vietnam to us. There's a civil war. The Soviets are backing one side. We're backing another side. We're going to fight and fight and fight. And what happens if our allies start to lose? Do we then intervene to keep them alive? Which is the way a lot of people saw Vietnam. Like, this is the same thing. So we're leaving Vietnam and we're going to Angola to fight the same exact kind of war. Members of Congress said, no, we're not going to do this. Now, this is an issue that came up in a big way during the Ford administration, because it's the Ford administration that's pumping this money into Angola. Well, Congress passes the Clark Amendment in 1975. It was an amendment to the Arms Export Control Act of 1976. Think about legislation when the United States government is passing any kind of legislation. There are amendments attached to that legislation for various things. This is the Arms Export Control Act, and what that is legislation which is passed every few years which guides how the United States sells weapons to other countries in the world, or the rules about how private manufacturers can sell weapons to other countries. It's all about foreign military sales as well. We sell weapons to our allies. And in this case, they added the Clark Amendment, named after Dick Clark, a senator from Idaho, which said that the United States cannot spend a single dime for any of the factions in the Angolan Civil War. It essentially said to Gerald Ford, you can talk about this all you want, but you can't spend any money at all in this Civil War. It essentially pulls the United States out of the Angolan conflict. Well, it was passed, legislation was successful, and the United States essentially was forced to withdraw from the Angolan conflict. Now, 2 points about that. One, this shows Congress's real power. If Congress wants to guide foreign policy, even control foreign policy, it can do it with money. It controls the spending. Congress very rarely uses this power, but it's important to understand that they can do it. And it's important to see why often they don't. We'll talk about some issues later on when Congress simply looks at it and says, we don't want to take the responsibility for this. Because actually what happened in Angola, this is the other point, is that the Soviet-backed MPLA won the Civil War. So the United States pulled out and Angola became a Marxist ally of the Soviet Union. Actually, the Clark Amendment was repealed in 1985 under Ronald Reagan. The Reagan administration, as part of fighting the Cold War, wanted to spend money for a rebel group. Actually, by this time in the 1980s, it was UNITA. That was that third rebel group I mentioned a few minutes ago. The United States government wanted to back UNITA at the time to fight the MPLA, which was still in power in Angola. And Congress actually voted to repeal the Clark Amendment and allow the United States to support UNITA. Now, that's by the book. That's the constitutional process. Congress at one point says, here's legislation which will guide foreign policy. 10 years later, they pass legislation essentially reversing the course, but it's all done by the book. That's the legislative process. So Congress uses its power, and then when Congress decides that it wants to change, well, it used its power to allow that funding in 1985. Now, just briefly, Angola is kind of an interesting case, because though the Marxist government won, it was kind of unusual. Their policies were strange. This is a Marxist government which has an economy, or runs a country whose economy is based on oil sales. And the Marxist government allowed Chevron and Gulf, United States oil companies, to pump as much oil out of the ground as possible. So they never seized the oil fields in the sense of saying to American oil companies, you can no longer pump oil here, you can no longer make money here. They said, please make as much money as possible, but you're going to give us a sizable cut of that money. We want it. So it was a weird kind of case. And actually, a South African-backed rebels, UNITA, this is the mid-70s and late 1970s, were trying to overthrow the Angolan government, and they figured the best way to deal with the Angolan government is to hurt the economy. So you had South Africa backing rebels, and the United States actually backing South Africa at this time, but these rebels were trying to blow up the oil fields of American oil companies. Kind of strange. To hurt the Marxists, we're going to attack American oil companies. Even stranger, the Angolan government said, we don't have the military capability to protect the oil fields. So here's Marxists saying, what do we do to protect the American oil fields? And the answer was to call up Fidel Castro and the communist regime in Cuba and get Fidel Castro to send Cuban troops to Angola to protect American oil companies. The Cold War gets bizarre sometimes. All right. The important thing, though, is Congress uses its power, and that's financial. Let's move on to slide 16. This is the second part of the post-Vietnam changes, the end of the U.S. foreign policy consensus. What we've got here on the slide is sort of a drawing that kind of helps it. If you think back to the Truman Doctrine, What you created at that time was a foreign policy consensus in which most people were about in the middle. Just about everybody agreed. We're containing communism. That's our goal. And the initial consensus was, essentially, that requires occasional intervention. Of course, deterrence, forward presence, all the things we talked about when we talked about the early Cold War, there was a consensus on all that, but there was also a consensus that occasionally we might have to intervene. So if you look on that top part of that slide, you'll see the left, you'll see the right, you'll see most Americans in the middle with a few people on the left and a few people on the right. Maybe the right consists of people who think we should use nuclear weapons in some of these fights rather than having these wars of attrition or limited wars. And people on the left may have been people saying, well, why are we fighting the Cold War? Why can't we come to an accommodation with the Soviet Union? But most people are in the center. They want to fight the Cold War, contain the Soviet Union. After Vietnam, you get a polarization in which that consensus fractures. So the drawing here shows still most people in the middle, but a lot more people on the left, a lot more people on the right. Now, the left are people who looked at Vietnam and said it was immoral, that the United States shouldn't have been there, that the problem was that we went ahead and we got involved in a civil war. Maybe it wasn't even about communism issues, but we made a mistake and we shouldn't intervene like that again. Like there are other ways of dealing with the Soviet Union. This wasn't a group of people who were saying, we think the Soviet Union is just fine and we have nothing wrong with communism. That's not what it was. It was that the United States needs to figure out a better way of dealing with the Soviet Union. Maybe not necessarily accommodating the Soviet Union and letting the Soviet Union do whatever it wanted, but that the use of force is not the way to do it. Now, what's the way to do it? That's a good question, because the left really never came up with a solution necessarily for how you deal with the Soviet Union if force is not an option. Actually, the center did. We'll talk about that in a little bit. That's detente. On the right, there were people who said the problem with the Vietnam War is that we sent troops in gradually. Remember the gradualism of sending in 50,000 troops and then another 25,000 troops, another 75,000 troops. What we should have done in Vietnam is from day one, send in 700,000 troops and capture the capital and destroy North Vietnam completely. This group said the problem in Vietnam is, and the problem in Korea is that we didn't fight hard enough. And if our fighting hard enough leads to World War III, then maybe we fight World War III. Well, so that's where the right was. And the right eventually becomes the Reagan administration. We'll get to that a little bit later. But you have this polarization. So people on the left, people on the right, people in the center, that's a really difficult environment for making foreign policy. In the old consensus era, all you needed to do was hit that target in the middle, and you satisfy 75 to 80% of the American population, which is certainly plenty to get strong public support for your foreign policy. Well, how do you create foreign policy if, let's say, 40% are in the middle, 30% are on the left, 30% on the right? Well, no matter what policy you choose, you've got 40 to 60% of the American population dissatisfied with your foreign policy. Well, who wants to be president in an environment like that? Maybe nobody, but of course, somebody wants to be president. We had several people living in that kind of environment, trying to make foreign policy in that kind of environment, and that was very, very difficult for them. So there's the situation in which the end of the foreign policy consensus creates a problem for any politician, any president, or any member of Congress trying to set foreign policy goals because there's so much disagreement. So keep that in mind because that becomes a very, very difficult environment. Now let's slide down a little bit and go to slide 17. This is the third post-Vietnam contextual difference in U.S. foreign policy. Now, don't worry about the slide for a second, but let's talk about the Vietnam syndrome. Vietnam syndrome is simply a phrase referring to nervousness about using force. After Vietnam, in public opinion poll after public opinion poll, Americans seem nervous that any time we use force, even in small ways, we make commitments. We make commitments, and those commitments lead to larger interventions. So we say, we're going to just do a little bit for Vietnam, and then we wind up with 500,000 troops there 3 years later. So there's a sense that the use of force creates commitments we can fulfill and commitments maybe we don't want to fulfill. So there's a nervousness about using force. That's the Vietnam syndrome. Some people actually say it's a notion that we'll never use force, and that's a little bit overblown, because actually in poll after poll after poll, Americans say, yes, using force abroad is necessary, but we need to think about it. We need to be smarter about it than we were during Vietnam. But in general, there's a dilemma for a president, for instance, to say, we're going to fight the Cold War, but how do you fight the Cold War without using force? How do you be a superpower without using force, especially when the Soviets seem willing to use force? Now, does this handicap us as a superpower? The Reagan administration, actually, as we'll see, said, yes, it does handicap us. But in the early 1970s, any president, Richard Nixon or Gerald Ford or Jimmy Carter, had to deal with the problem of Americans were saying, wait. Before you use force, let's think about this. Now, if Americans are saying, anytime we use force, there could be another Vietnam, well, presidents have to be worried. And that's what the slides show. If you take a look at this, public opinion on the Vietnam War, 1965 to 1973. If you take a look at this, and the question is actually, was Vietnam a mistake? So that's the question that people are asking. And if you look at it, you see 1960s, mid-1965, you'll see about 60% of the population said, no, Vietnam was not a mistake. So they're saying Vietnam was a good idea. And about 25% of the population think Vietnam is a mistake. And then you take a look for 66, 67. By the time you get to 1968, you see a crossover in which about 45% of Americans say Vietnam was a mistake. About 45% say, no, Vietnam was not a mistake, and there's still some don't knows. Then you see 1969, 1970, 1971, 72, and on. You're up to the point where you get 60% of Americans saying Vietnam was a mistake, and only about 30% saying Vietnam was not a mistake, we still support the war. So opinion of the war turned around drastically. And the reason for that was casualties. As casualties mounted, more and more Americans said, why are we here? What are we doing? Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that Americans are nervous about the use of force entirely, that all force is bad. What it means is Americans are looking at the cost of this and say that, yes, the independence of South Vietnam was important, but not at the cost of 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 Americans. Right. Ultimately, 58,000 Americans died there. So the question is, how many casualties is Vietnam worth? And Americans over time said, you know, it wasn't worth that much. There's a chart exactly like this for the invasion of Iraq, invasion and intervention in Iraq in 2003. Same type of chart. Americans were supportive of an intervention in Iraq, and when they saw the cost in terms of people, and in terms of money, they turned against the war and said, you know, we want Iraq to be rid of Saddam Hussein, but it's not worth this much men, women, and material. It's just not worth that much. So the American people are actually making a judgment about the costs of intervention, not necessarily about intervention in general. But this creates a problem for an American president who says, we want to fight the Cold War, but the American people are nervous about this. They're going to hold my feet to the fire about the cost of this war. So that's a context for everything that we're going to talk about when we talk about engagement, and then we talk about the confrontation sections. So let me stop there, and we're going to move to a lecture on engagement, which will be the next one.